Welcome to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's 3:06 and you're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today on Central Time, we're talking about a Wisconsin video game success story, why one person says religion in public schools is still alive and kicking, and news about the state budget.
But first, some economic news. This week's stock slid after Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke announced that the Fed could dial back its bond buying program by the middle of next year.
Yeah, the Dow had this year's biggest drop of the year, a day after Chairman Bernanke said the economy is on the upswing.
And Wells Fargo, the nation's largest mortgage lender, raised its advertised rate since the supposed good news about our economy.
Well, to figure out how this all affects you, we're talking to Chris Farrell, economics editor of Marketplace Money. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, how does Chairman Bernanke's announcement that the economy is improving affect the average American?
Well, you know, markets tend to overreact. I think you probably have noticed this over a period of time.
They get skittish.
So, you know, interest rates had been rising since about mid-May. And so if you think about look at the mortgage rate, it was up about half a percentage point since May to the middle of June. And everyone's kind of been having this conversation, at least who's involved in the markets, about, you know, interest rates are starting to climb. Interest rates are going to go up. The economy's growing. You know, at some point, Bernanke's going to say, the Fed is going to say, we're going to stop this support to the economy. And then it's on June 19th. He comes out and says, hey, economy's getting a little better, labor market's getting a little better, and everyone goes, oh, no, he actually might do it. He really might. And he didn't do anything. Remember, they're continuing this massive bond buying program that they have. It didn't raise their short-term benchmark interest rate. All he said is that we think the economy's getting stronger. So, in essence, the market said the day of tapering is coming closer, and you saw the reaction.
Now, that's maybe a temporary glitch in the market,
yeah.
But is this announcement from Chairman Bernanke going to mean, as I mentioned, Wells Fargo raised some mortgage rates? Is this going to mean higher mortgage rates for us in the months and year to come?
I think in terms of the consumer, there's a couple of things to emphasize. One is the era of low rates is over. But that doesn't mean rates are going to climb very quickly. So mortgage rates had been going up. There is more activity going in the housing market. But I don't expect much of a rise in mortgage rates beyond what we've seen, but a little bit. Auto loans probably won't move very much because right now the auto industry with their financing, they're interested in continuing to move the iron. So they're going to continue to give incentives for you to buy. Credit cards, they're already high as it is, probably go up a little bit. So I think what we're going to see, I would mark this as a juncture. Interest rates are coming off their historic lows. But consumers should not feel any pressure whatsoever to rush out. And if you're thinking about buying a car, if you're thinking about buying a home, look, don't feel the pressure because of rising interest rates to do something because they're not going to go up very far, very fast.
And to wrap up, you said part of the announcement is that the labor market is looking a bit better. How are things looking for people out there who are in the job market looking for a job? Are they going to notice a difference?
They're noticing a very small difference. Yes, there is more hiring going on. There's not much hiring going on for wages. Wages are not going to move anywhere. So gradually, yes, the private sector economy is growing at a decent pace, and the private sector economy is starting to pick up its hiring. Where a lot of the dead weight on this economy and where you're seeing the job losses is in the government sector. And that is really a drag on the economy. But if you're looking for a job in the private sector, it's getting slightly better. Not good, but slightly better.
Chris, thank you so much for helping us make sense of that news.
Thanks a lot.
That was Chris Farrell, economics editor of Marketplace Money.
It's Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. There's a call for more volunteers for ambulance services in rural areas around the state. In some places, it could make the difference between having local first responders or waiting twice as long for help to arrive. WPR's Mike Simonson has this story.
Chalk is one of just four emergency medical technicians in the Glidden Ambulance Service. But it isn't just Glidden. They serve remote places like Jacobs, Peeksville, Gordon, and Shanagolden. So Shock says the volunteer EMTs are in each other's hip pocket.
Because we're telling each other where we are all the time. I'm saying, you know, if I'm going to the grocery store, I'm emailing Sharon and saying, I'm going to the grocery store, I'll be out of town 2 hours.
Shock has been a volunteer EMT since 1975. Now as director of the all-volunteer Glidden Ambulance Service, she says their situation is dire. Either they double their volunteer numbers or they shut down.
We don't have young people staying here anymore. They're moving away. They're going to bigger cities to get jobs or going to school and become educated and do things away from us.
So last month they called an emergency town meeting. 25 people showed up in the Jacobs Town Hall. Gordon Town Chairman Doug Thompson says that's not enough.
I don't understand it. I mean, this is something that affects literally every single person and every single family in our four townships.
Right.
I mean, this is everybody. And 25 people show up, and then they'll all be crying if it just goes away.
If the volunteer ambulance service goes away, the townships can contract with nearby Mellon and Park Falls. But that's expensive, and Thorpe says it could double response time.
It's going to take half an hour to an hour before the ambulance can get here. Maybe I should move somewhere closer where I know I can get to the hospital in 10 minutes and say, you know, if I have a heart attack, the odds are the first hour is golden, they say, right?
That's right.
They ain't never going to get there in an hour if it takes 45 minutes or a half hour for an ambulance to get here.
Last year, the Glidden Ambulance Service made 63 emergency calls. Shock says the norm used to be 150, but like many rural areas, their population is declining. About two-thirds of Wisconsin's 808 fire departments and ambulance services rely on volunteers. Wisconsin EMT coordinator Ray Lemke says most of them are holding their own, but some are like Glidden and struggling to recruit volunteers.
As times change and as attitudes change, sometimes we see that the spirit of volunteerism is diminished a little bit throughout the state, and from time to time it waxes and wanes. We have done some interventions with them as far as provide some tactical and technical assistance out of our office here to assist those services, and if there are things that we can do, suggestions we have made.
Lemke suggests that they hold a community event and let people know they need help. It does take commitment. People are required to take several hours of training to be certified as an EMT and then take a refresher course every 2 years. Back at the Jacobs Town Hall, half a dozen people came forward to sign up for certification training. 29-year-old Gary Eater of Glidden says he'll do what it takes.
If this ambulance service falls apart, this town's going to go with it. I mean, it's one of the last things holding this community together, because without it, everybody's going to leave to get health care elsewhere.
Brandon Doherty's dad needed the ambulance recently, so the 30-year-old is signing up too.
Because they needed it up here. What are they going to do if they lose it?
If four of the six new volunteers pass the training and become certified by September, the Glidden Ambulance Service will continue to operate. Mike Simonson, Wisconsin Public Radio in Glidden.
I want to hear that comes out in September. Producers, let's make a note to check in with Mike and see what happens in the fall.
Coming up, UW Stout's Got Game. We'll meet one of the creators of an award-winning computer game. Coming up next, I'm Veronica Vickers.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Join Cynthia Schuster and WPR reporter Sean Johnson Monday for the State Capitol Report. They're going to take a look at what's happening in state politics, including the latest news on the state budget. That's Monday at 7 on the Joy Cardine Show.
Kristen Durst is with us now with a look at some headlines we're keeping an eye on. Kristen, take it away.
Thanks. President Barack Obama has named James Comey to be the new FBI director. Comey was the number two Justice Department official under George W. Bush. He gained attention for blocking efforts by the Bush White House to reauthorize a no-warrant wiretapping program in 2004. An underground tank holding some of the worst radioactive waste at the nation's most contaminated nuclear site might be leaking into the soil. The Energy Department says it's looking into the situation at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Washington State. The department says workers detected higher radioactivity levels yesterday while inspecting a tank that's older than its intended lifespan. Governor Scott Walker is staying mostly quiet about what he may veto in his state budget that cleared the legislature early this morning, although it is unlikely he'll touch his top priorities, including a $650 million income tax cut, expansion of private school vouchers, rejection of Medicaid expansion, and a tuition freeze at UW.
Thanks, Kristen. And there's more news coming up in about 15 minutes. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time.
Some cool news out of Menominee now. A group of student developers at UW-Stout have spent months designing and programming a video game called Flash Frozen.
Last month, they were selected as finalists in a national game design competition, beating out universities from all across the country.
They just traveled to Los Angeles to show off their game at the Electronic Entertainment Expo, or E3 as it's known, and while there, were named co-champions of the competition.
Sam Armstrong is the lead designer of Flash Frozen, and he's here to tell us more about this Wisconsin-made game that's caught the eye of the video game industry. Sam, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob and Veronica. How are you two doing?
Really good. Well, good. Tell us about Flash Frozen.
Well, Flash Frozen is a survival horror game where the player must escape from a flooding and freezing cruise ship while managing their own body heat in order to survive.
Sounds complicated, and I like the mix of the horror and everything else going on there. How did you get the idea for it?
Honestly, we sat down as a part of our capstone project during our senior year, and we were given a week to develop a pitch for what kind of game we would like to make over the course of the year. Only two games were selected, and I literally just pulled it out of a hat. It just came to me as I continued writing down crazy ideas, and I thought, you know, what kind of games did I like to play, and what kind of ideas have I not really tried out with my own independently created prototypes? And honestly, it just seemed to work out. I put together a solid pitch, and I got picked as one of the two different projects to be worked on.
I took a look at the trailer for the game, which is linked, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page, and something that struck me is, even just in that little snippet of the game, there's definitely a mood. I mean, I felt emotionally moved watching it. Can you talk about what went into setting the mood for the game?
Honestly, many, many different things go into building atmosphere in a video game environment. It's much like building atmosphere in film, except it's a little bit more immersive because usually you have some control in how you engage in the environment. So really good music is a good... good place to start. You don't want to overpower them with it, but it needs to add a slight bit of atmosphere, low, deep tones, or like if you watch the trailer, really nice piano music. We had a great musician do some work for that. And the other thing is immersion through realism in terms of sound effects. So, you know, a good creepy sound of creaking metal, the sound of wind rolling past some ice, just the little things that bring you into the atmosphere that kind of keep you in the idea that this is a living, breathing environment. The last couple of things is all about aesthetics in terms of visually. You've got the lighting in itself. It has a deep green undertones in many of the sections of the ship in order to give you an idea of feeling almost underwater, of somberness, of, you know, isolation. And then combine that with the wonderful models that our team managed to put together for actually populating the environment with vast amounts of ice and almost surreal patterns. It creates a very almost claustrophobic and terrifyingly alien atmosphere with a lot of familiarity, because these are things that you know you recognize from both popular culture or your own experiences on ships.
So Rob and I are both kind of self-proclaimed nerds, mm-hmm. and we would have liked to have played the game, but we didn't get a chance to.
Well,
what are some of the terrifying things that happen if you fail spectacularly?
Is it too scary for us?
Right.
Well, no, not at all. It's well, for one, freezing to death is not exactly the funnest thing in the world. Mm-hmm. Not from personal experience, I can't tell you. But definitely in the game, it creates a sense of panic. As you continue to get colder and colder in the environment, ice starts to creep in around your vision, obscuring it eventually to the point where you can become confused and lost. This makes, you know, progression outside of any areas where you have considerable warmth is nerve-wracking, but you need to progress forward in order to, you know, escape the ship at all. So the necessity for leaving the warmth behind and carefully navigating through the environment is one of the great, you know, stresses of that. Combine that with the constant loss of heat, just like you would in a real life situation, you feel very connected to, you know, what you're playing as in the game as the character. In terms of the horror in of itself, there's something on the ship with you.
I thought so.
Mm-hmm. We prefer to keep it a secret. The game is currently floating around on the internet. It is free, so So you can play it. Actually, if you go to my website, armstrongsand.com, and look in my portfolio work, there's a direct link to the torrent for it, and you can download it. It should be up on a couple of different torrent sites later today. In order to, and of course, our own website, flashfrozengame.com. I have to get a hold of our website manager so he can update that. But so you can get a chance to play it. But no, there is something on the ship. It is.
And it's not a kitten.
No, it's not a kitten. It's not happy to see you. And in fact, it enjoys the challenges that you're currently facing. Huh. And it will do everything it can to make sure you stay right where you belong on the bottom, at the very bottom rung of that ship. I'm not going to reveal what it is. It's part of the mystery. Go play the game and see if you can figure out what it is. Because there is a narrative to this. There is story. There is leavings behind by the crew who are not there anymore. And if you read up on what they've left behind, you can definitely figure out what is happening and get a good inclination of what this thing is on this ship with you.
Well, now, for video game fans, the E3, where you took this game for the competition, it's kind of the holy grail of trade shows. What was it like actually being there?
Oh, there's nothing quite like seeing a booth that's probably worth somewhere in multi-million dollars and is larger than most homes. Two stories tall, and it's built inside of another building.
And this is the UW Stout booth, right?
Entirely. Actually, UW Stout has been wonderfully supportive of us. They did a great job at securing funds for getting our entire team out there, which was honestly far beyond our expectations, which has actually allowed us to have such a strong showing at the show. But no, we had a small booth with a single station that allowed us to show off our game, and we had somewhere around maybe 300 people combined play total over the course of the 3 days. So it was a very good turnout for us, especially with the fact that many of those people that did turn out were from major industry players like Sony and Microsoft, a number of gentlemen from Infinity Ward and Treyarch, the developers from the Call of Duty series, came by and had a great deal of interest in our game because we shared a lot of similarities in our development style with large set pieces and a first-person perspective of what they do.
So you were the co-champion. So what does that mean for the game? Where does it go next?
Well, the game, as it stands right now, there were 12 people that worked on the game. Each of us owns a separate and equal share, thanks to the actual nice, again, the University of Wisconsin Stout was kind enough to let us own our own intellectual property, something that's not common for many of the universities out there. But with that, many of us are not entering into the video game industry. Many of us are leaving the video game industry permanently or want nothing to do with it. Subsequently, continuing on with this game in terms of a development process is a very sticky legal situation. So we are choosing to release it for free online and leave it up there as a portfolio piece for now. We are completely open to anyone approaching us with any other opportunities, but at the moment, that's just how it's going to have to remain.
Now, that game development design program at UW Stout's only been around for a few years, right? Can you talk about how you went from nothing at all to a national champion in a short time?
Well, it was a lot of work by the students and professors both. One of the things that the school itself did was to reach out to industry members in order to build its curriculum. They contacted Raven Software. I believe they're out in Madison right now. They are a subsidiary of Activision, and they helped them build their original curriculum. In turn, they also reached out to a gentleman by the name of Ken Patterson, who runs a company called Big John Games here in the Twin Cities. And they, in fact, he came in and taught on a weekly basis to the students, so you can have an actual industry member come in and speak to the students about, you know, whatever, you know, topic that he needed to discuss in terms of the process of game development and design. He brought in his team to critique and analyze our concepts and our programming and art, and helped us overall to create much better products and games. Combined with that, the students themselves have done a heck of a lot of work to try and, you know, promote themselves. Menominee, Wisconsin isn't exactly known for its connections to the greater video game industry. We've done everything we can out there in order to really improve that. We set up a chapter of the International Game Developers Association, the IGDA. I set that up with a partner of mine in my freshman year, and I was president of that for about 2 years. And what we did was we would contact industry members and bring them in to speak. paying them if we had to, and creating something called a game jam, where you would go in and for 48 hours you would make really rapid prototypes of a game, and then people would judge them, and you win prizes and things like that. And it's a way to get students motivated. We also held, at one point in time, we held weekly meetings. We're back to biweekly meetings when the year goes towards an end or over the summer, to teach other students, from the older students to the younger students, so they can learn what they've learned if they have the interest beforehand of entering into the industry.
Sam, thanks so much for being with us today. It's been a lot of fun.
No problem.
Looking forward to finding out what's rattling around that ship.
Me too. I'm picturing it as an ice kitten of doom. I don't think that's really it, though.
Well, that was Sam Armstrong. He's just graduated from UW-Stout, and he's the lead designer for Flash Frozen.
And we've got a link to the game's website on the Central Time Facebook page. You can see some screenshots and a trailer of the game. Now, we've heard in the past that public radio listeners are not always big video game or computer game people. Veronica, you and I are.
Right.
And I'm interested to hear from you. You can go to our Central Time Facebook page or send us an email at talk@wpr.org. Do you have a favorite video game, a favorite computer game, past or present? Let us know at the Central Time Facebook page. Veronica, what's one of yours?
I challenge anyone to a game of Galaga.
See, I like Galaga. I'm very, very bad at Galaga.
So good.
I do not accept your challenge.
I don't know about Flash Frozen, though. I mean, it looks beautiful, and you literally feel chilled while you look at that trailer. It does definitely give you that sense of impending doom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, coming up after the news, we'll take a look at prayer in school and why there might be more religion in public education than ever before. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time, the last pilot of Central Time before we start up in July. On July 1st, by the way, 5 days a week. Stick around, there's a lot more to come, including the news, right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
This week marks the 50th anniversary of a landmark Supreme Court ruling that effectively banned school-sponsored prayer in public schools. You might think this would decrease the overall presence of religion, but our guest says there might be even more religion in schools now than when the ruling came down.
And we'd like to hear from you on this one. Do you see the presence of religion in schools today? And if you see it, how do you feel about it? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Lee Lawrence is the author of this month's cover story in the Christian Science Monitor called Was God Expelled? And Lee, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's an honor to be on your new program.
Oh, thanks for being here with us. Well, school prayer was banned by the Supreme Court 50 years ago, so supposedly church and state separated, done deal. But you're saying not so fast. There's more religion out there in schools than you might think. How much are you seeing?
Well, I mean, I think that there are two kinds of religion in schools that you have to make a, sort of distinguish. And one is school-sponsored religion. And then there is the free expression of religion by students. And, in fact, even the private expression, maybe by teachers who privately pray, but they're not leading anybody else in prayer, nobody sees them. So what I found was that because of the laws that have come up since, you have a lot of religious clubs on campuses that are allowed to form. Not on every campus. The school has to have what they call a limited open forum. If a school allows students to band together to create clubs that are not attached to anything that's in the curriculum. So a Spanish club would be a curricular club, but perhaps a chess club wouldn't be. So if they allow things that are not attached to the curriculum to form, then they have to allow, according to a much later Supreme Court ruling from 1990, they have to allow a religious club to form. And so you see a lot of religious clubs on campuses that the problem with quantifying is that actually nobody has actually tallied it, because it's an enormous proposition to do so, to go to 90,000 plus public schools around the country and figure out who has religious clubs and who doesn't. So, but the sense is that certainly they are there. They are very vibrant, and a lot of groups are actually very intentionally approaching students in schools and encouraging them to start these student-led and student-initiated clubs.
Now, you said there are two things. They're the clubs that you're just talking about, but there is also school-supported religion. What would be an example of that?
Well, that would be that would be illegal, is what it would be. That would be in places where maybe the school has had a prayer that the teacher conducted or that the administration in some way presented, and then you have court cases, and we have court cases all the time that erupt on whether the cheerleaders can hold up a Bible verse before the football game, or whether the school can allow a student to conduct a prayer at graduation. And some regional courts have said yes under certain conditions, and some regional courts have said no under very similar conditions. So that hasn't worked itself out yet.
And so I guess the one thing we do know is that this is not over. It's still unfolding in the courts, it sounds like. Where are the flashpoints in that legal battle?
Well, the flashpoints are these kinds of gray areas where a school says, you know, a student wants to lead the students have elected a representative, and he or she to serve at sort of to preside, let's say, over some kind of a ceremony at graduation, and they'd like to say a prayer, and so that's contentious. There was a case recently of an elementary school graduation where they wanted to have prayer. They wanted to have a clergy member come in, and that was deemed wrong and unlawful. So they the whole school decided to cancel the graduation entirely. So there's still a lot of argument around it. I mean, the Supreme Court's been pretty clear and pretty consistent on the issue of prayer, in terms of nothing that is school-sponsored, that is therefore state-sponsored, because it was felt that with the state apparatus and the state power behind it, you were, even if you made that prayer non-mandatory, you were really imposing some kind of an indirect coercion onto the students and favoring religion and then a particular religion within that. So some of it is still working itself out. Some of it has worked itself out in terms of how religious clubs can conduct themselves, what are the parameters under which they can conduct themselves. And those seem to actually be worked out pretty well, and there are glitches, I'm sure, and there are some places where the rules are unclear and they work, you know, somebody complains and then it gets rectified. But in other places, well, and also for after-school programs, there's religion on campus in a different way, which is, If a school allows an after-school program like the 4-H or Girl Scouts to discuss matters of honesty and ethics and morals, etc., then some clubs have argued, well, if we want to discuss those same issues in an after-school program that is not mandatory, parents have to, you know, allow you to come, but from a religious point of view, you can't exclude us. And a case in 2001... at the Supreme Court, granted that, said absolutely that would be to not let you a group do that would be violating its freedom of speech. That case was far more contentious, even in the arguments of the Supreme Court, than the 1962 and 1963 cases, where there was really only one dissenting voice at each one. And in the case about these after school programs, the argument was far more contentious, and the vote was 6-3, with one of those six agreeing, but only in part, with some reservations.
So is it fair to say, then, that there is more religion in schools now than there was 50 years ago?
Well, you know, it's a tricky thing to say, because empirically that's a hard one to prove. But you certainly can say that there's more variety of religion, religious expression, because certainly 50 years ago you didn't have a Muslim Student Association, and you probably didn't have a Jewish student union and a Hindu club. So there is a broader variety of religious expression. And you could argue that having a prayer that is broadcast over the loudspeaker every day that becomes sort of rote is far less religious than having a group meet and discuss Bible before class. who are, you know, really well, who are intent as a, and paying attention, as opposed to whatever percentage of the student body who might just be thinking of other things while this prayer is being said over their heads.
We're talking with Lee Lawrence about her cover story in this month's Christian Science Monitor called Was God Expelled? And we want to hear from you, too. Where do you see the presence of religion showing up in schools today, and how do you feel about it? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or let us know on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll get to your calls in just a bit. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. There's more Central Time just ahead here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday on At Issue, John Munson and his guests discuss sibling bullying, which, according to a new study, can be just as psychologically damaging to kids as peer bullying. That's At Issue, Monday at 3.
Right now, here's Kristen Durst with a few headlines we're keeping an eye on this afternoon.
Thanks. The judge in the trial of a Florida Neighborhood Watch volunteer will allow prosecutors to argue in opening statements that George Zimmerman profiled Trayvon Martin before shooting him, as long as they don't say the profiling was based on race. Judge Deborah Nelson says prosecutors are free to say Zimmerman profiled the 17-year-old based on factors such as age or clothing. Opening statements in the second-degree murder trial are expected on Monday. Firefighters aren't holding out much hope of saving the Colorado tourist town of South Fork. A massive wildfire is headed toward the community in the state's southwestern mountains, which has about 400 full-time residents. They've been evacuated. The organizer of what would have been Wausau's first gay pride parade has canceled the event, saying he's experienced ugliness in the community. Dax Bovier says he's called off tomorrow's parade after negative comments from a city council member and in articles in local media.
Thanks, Kristen. We'll hear more news coming up at 4 o'clock.
We continue our discussion now on religion in schools with Lee Lawrence, and we're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And, Lee, I want to ask you about the issue of religious tolerance. Now, some of what we've just been talking about has been these religious clubs that are student-led, and they take place, you know, maybe before school starts or after school. There are not adults present. But then you also have religious instruction, which comes without a point of view and that kind of thing. Some people are saying, you know what? That promotes religious tolerance and gives students a handle on plurality, diversity, things like that. What does that look like right now?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that is, in fact, another way that you could say it's school-sponsored religion, but it's not school-sponsored religious activity. It's school-sponsored classes about religion. And what that looks like right now is there are some courses on the Bible, as literature on the Bible is an influential document, you know, that has influenced civilization and the arts and culture. That's one way it manifests itself. And then there are world religion classes. There's the AP and other world history classes that deal a lot with religion. And, you know, when it's done well, what it basically, the teacher presents, not that this is the truth, but this is what this group of people believed it was the truth, and this is why these actions, what prompted these actions grew out of that belief, and tries to relate historical events and historical developments to the prevailing religious beliefs of the people. And in terms of teaching religion, you know, a lot of teachers feel like they haven't gotten the proper training and either shy away from it entirely or inadvertently sometimes do it wrong, not realizing that they're slipping into some behaviors that, in fact, move away from an objective academic stance. So, for example, one example is, it sounds perfectly great to say, okay, you know, let's see what a Seder looks like. We'll just perform one. Well, the scholars and people who've written guidelines on how to teach about religion will say, you know, don't go there. Just stick to the, you know, don't go into play acting and then moving into a ritual, because then that line between what's a ritual and what's an explanation of a ritual is lost.
Well, we're talking with Lee Lawrence, who wrote the cover story on this month's Christian Science Monitor called Was God Expelled? As we look at religion in schools. And we go to the phones now. Let's talk to Deborah in Brown Deer. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. You know, it's confusing to to think that someone might consider religion offensive, because crime seems to be so prevalent in our society. I get sick watching the news and listening to everything that happens on a daily basis in Milwaukee, and it's probably right up there with the rest of the cities, you know, as far as crime rate. But did I miss something? I mean, do they teach evolution and that's okay? But I'm not a right to life or a born again Christian. I'm really looking at this objectively, and I think they should be grateful and happy to have people thinking, praying about, and contemplating peace.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, Deborah. And Lee, I know you wrote about some schools where religious figures were welcomed into the schools for similar reasons to the ones Deborah is talking about.
You know, it's that's always tricky, because when you have a community that has a lot of violence, where there are drugs, where the options for a lot of kids are really bad, it's easy to then welcome clergy in because they're willing to lend a hand. But there are a lot of ways that clergy and people of faith do and have lent a hand and still do lend a hand without imposing their religious beliefs, without turning that into a proselytizing act. And yet still, everybody knows that they come from the church, so people know. And a student after class can trot behind them and say, well, you know, you're such a nice guy. What's your secret? And a lot of church volunteers that I spoke to sort of hope that will happen in that time, you know, after the school, and not initiated by them, but initiated by the student. I think what is important to keep in mind, and what the Supreme Court certainly underlined, was that the minute you have the school engaging in religious activities or endorsing them and supporting them, then you have to ask what religion. And maybe that would change depending on how the government shifted. So would people feel happy if somebody is praying in a manner that really goes against their conscience and their belief this year, when maybe 10 years ago they were quite in sync with it? So it's an understandable feeling to want a religious and a center and a moral center injected in the school, and it is, in a lot of ways, that can be secular without crossing the line into imposing or into supporting one religious point of view over another.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Deborah. And we move next to Jared, who's with us from Green Bay. Hey, Jared.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
First off, I'd like to say that this I'm coming from a biased perspective a little bit, because I have a degree in biology, and I have an aspiration of becoming a teacher. So the whole business of teaching evolution in schools and so forth is kind of a sore spot for me. I'd like to point out that we do still have a separation of church and state. It's down there in the Constitution. And as nice as all this, you know, ecumenical business sounds, you are going to reach a point where if you give them an inch, they take, you know, an entire foot or mile or whatever. I imagine that having a group of, you know, students or priests or whatever in a school is going to make it harder for teachers to handle, you know, exactly the thing I was discussing. And it just seems so much cleaner to just, you know, leave it out and accept it. For a perspective, there was once a time in this country when you had different groups of Protestants oppressing each other. That's why we had separation of church and state, to stop that from happening. Thank you, and I'll take my comment off the air.
All right. Thanks, Jared. Deborah? I'm sorry, Lee? Going back to Deborah.
Oh, Deborah. My twin sister. the caller is absolutely right that the Protestants, you know, there's a wide array of points of view within Christianity, and certainly even within Protestant Christianity. And so it gets very, as I was saying earlier, the Supreme Court was very clear of not having civil authority and religion alighted in any way, that was dangerous, and it could erode the freedom of religion. And so it was a slippery slope that they didn't want to touch. There's a lot of teaching of character. There's a lot of teaching of morals in schools. Evolution and the teaching of evolution that your caller brought up, that's a whole other article that, unfortunately, I haven't tackled yet. But that doesn't mean according to the laws and in the practice that I've seen, that religious clubs as long as they are done by students, initiated by students, led by students. And although an adult can be present, the adult is the school sponsor who sits in a supervisory role because they want to make sure that, you know, a group of 15-year-olds don't come up with some bright idea that, in fact, is actually against school policy or they feel might be divisive. And so that's when the school sponsor can step in. But the school sponsor can't lead it, can't decide what they should be doing, can guide in that sort of supervisory way, but not take the leadership. I don't know if that answers what his concern was, but there are two ways that religion can be present.
Right. Thank you for that call. And you do point out in your piece, Lee, that sometimes it's the case that there is a clergy figure who goes to a student as a sort of a liaison and sort of helps them instigate this group. Does that happen a lot as you see it?
Well, from what I can gather, and all this evidence, I hate to say, is still anecdotal because, as I said, there's no sociological study that has amassed quantities of data. But people who are in the field and who look at this, to the extent that they look at it, there is a sense that a lot of times it's a youth pastor, an adult, a concerned a person of faith who knows this young person, who says, well, why don't you start a club on campus? And there's really nothing... There's nothing illegal about that. We come on campus with the opinions of our parents. We come on campus with what happened to us over the weekend. We can't shed that at the gate. So where it crosses the line is if that youth pastor starts really directing the group, perhaps, and the group is set up as a student-initiated and student-led. The students also can invite youth pastors to come and talk, or imams or rabbis. They can invite people to come, and the law that governs these student-initiated clubs states that they cannot regularly attend, but that's kind of open to interpretation. So I guess that, to me, that sort of means that unless anybody complains that it's overstepping the line because that leadership that person is actually taking too much leadership, then that passes.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get to another call here. We have Boyd joining us from Wautoma. Hi, Boyd.
Hi, Veronica. Good luck to you and your new show.
Oh, thank you.
You know, this topic reminds me of something I saw on Yahoo a couple weeks ago where a gentleman at his high school graduation, he was class valedictorian, and he had torn up his speech that he was going to give and instead decided to give the Lord's Prayer. And he was met with a lot of praise and cheers from fellow classmates and people in the audience. And what just, from my own perspective, got me thinking was, well, you know, maybe it's within his First Amendment rights to do that. But I would say the community, and this was in South Carolina, that supported him, would they be just as supportive if, let's say, the following year, the class valedictorian is Jewish and wants to read something from the Tanakh, or it's a Muslim and wants to pray toward Mecca, or, you know, let's take it one step further, someone who's a follower of Anton LaVey in the Church of Satan, they'd say, well, I'd like to give a prayer, and I'm the valedictorian, and, you know, aren't these within my rights? And I think this is why, you know, and this sort of, to add on what the previous caller said, this is why you have the separation of church and state. And I just don't think, and I hope I don't sound condescending, I don't think a lot of people in our country understand why there is separation of church and state and why it is relevant and why we need it even more so.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Boyd. And Lee, what do you think?
Well, Boyd brings up a very good point that the feeling is among a lot of people who are looking at this is that, well, you have to be prepared to accept anybody's prayer and welcome it just as much. And that's, it's funny, on the student prayer, standing up and praying, when the school hasn't told him how, you know, what to say, and the school hasn't vetted it, so there's no administration behind him or any kind of teacher who's in any way counseled him, some courts will say that's okay, and some courts will say no. So that's very much in the air, that's under discussion. And the way people look at history is interesting. In the first case, the Engel v. Vitale, which was 1962, the judges who ruled against having this prayer, which was a pretty generic prayer, made the big point that the nation was founded by people who were coming, fleeing religious persecution, not or having seen, even if they were not themselves affected, having seen what a state religion could do, and really feeling very strongly that the government should not be involved in religion. And the dissenter felt like, well, if you take away prayer, he looked at it historically in a different way. The one dissenting justice was Justice Stewart, and he said, well, by taking away the prayer, you're taking away a whole tradition that's just a tradition of spirituality that has defined the U.S.
And we have to leave it there. It's an ongoing discussion, one that we'll be watching. And Lee, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Lee Lawrence. She's a writer and a filmmaker, and we've got a link to her story, Was God Expelled, on the Central Time Facebook page.
In just a few minutes, we'll be joined by WPR foodie Lori Skelton, who's got some fresh ideas for what to do with your strawberries this summer. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.